The Institute.
Institute.
Institute for Justice.
The National Law Firm for Liberty.
Hello and welcome to Short Circuit, your usually bi-weekly podcast on the Federal Courts of Appeal. I'm your host, John Ross, joined today by IJ Senior Attorney Paul Sherman, as well as special guest Clark Neely, the Vice President of Criminal Justice at the Cato Institute. If you enjoy the show, please do us a favor and write a review on iTunes. Before we kick things off, Clark, you're a founding member of the show. Tell us what you're up to at Cato.
Well, thanks so much for having me back. It's really a pleasure to be here with you and Paul, and wonderful to be back on Short Circuit. Over at Cato, I'm working on criminal justice, as you mentioned. And basically what I've tried to do is get a handle on what I think are the most fundamental problems in our criminal justice system that are also particularly amenable to challenge and hopefully ultimately improvement from a libertarian perspective. And for me, it really shakes out to three or four things. And the first is no surprise. I think that a lot of our constitutional or a lot of our criminal law is unconstitutional for various reasons. But we have a real problem in this country, I believe, with unconstitutional overcriminalization. That leads to what we call self-defeating policing, because the people against whom those laws are being enforced are very aware of how problematic they are, and they really resent the fact that they are being singled out while people in other communities typically don't bear the brunt of those enforcement efforts. Then another problem is what I call the practical elimination of citizen participation in the criminal justice system. What happened is basically prosecutors have developed such incredibly coercive tools to extract confessions from people that most criminal cases are now resolved through plea bargains, and those are often extraordinarily coercive to the point where I've really come to believe that there is no reason to have faith in the integrity of any particular conviction that has been obtained through plea bargain. I'm not saying they're all problematic, but there's no way to know because the system by which they're often extracted is just not one that has integrity. And then finally, all of this takes place in an atmosphere of near zero accountability for law enforcement, which just compounds the problems that we've talked about.
Yeah, one of the things that I find really astonishing is just essentially the demise of the criminal jury trial. And it's something that, you know, if you watch, if most of what you know about the law is what you see on television, like Law and Order, you would think that, oh, jury trials are happening all the time. And in fact, what is it, like 90%?
More than 95% of criminal convictions today are obtained through plea bargain.
Yeah.
Yep. And if you look at the mechanism by which that happens, I mean, we're talking about the leverage that's provided with mandatory minimums, meaning if you don't take the plea and you go to trial and lose, the judge has no discretion and they have to sentence you to. I mean, they hand out decades in the federal criminal system like Halloween candy. Prosecutors also have extraordinarily coercive tactics they can bring to bear in the investigation phase. They can threaten family members with indictment. They can threaten friends. If you do go to trial, prosecutors are allowed to bribe witnesses, and they bribe them with the only thing more valuable than money, which is freedom, whereas all their lawyers are not permitted to do that. In fact, it's a felony for anyone who's not a prosecutor to bribe a witness. So the list goes on and on. The playing field is extraordinarily unlevel, and it's usually problematic, both from the standpoint of depriving individuals of the right to have a jury trial, which is an incredibly valuable right, but also because it, as I pointed out earlier, it has virtually eliminated citizen participation in the criminal justice system. And I really believe that a criminal justice system cannot function properly without significant citizen participation. And I think that's one of the reasons why the jury gets more ink in the Bill of Rights than any other topic. Think about that for a minute. The Bill of Rights spends more time talking about juries than any other subject, and we have practically eliminated them, both from our civil and, more importantly, from our criminal justice systems. And I think it's been a disaster.
Yeah. And how much time does the Constitution spend talking about absolute prosecutorial immunity and qualified immunity?
Interestingly enough, there's nothing in the Constitution about it, nothing in federal law about it. It was invented out of whole cloth by the Supreme Court.
You don't say.
Mm-hmm.
Well, speaking of immunity, Clark, yesterday you tweeted about what may be the single best qualified immunity case you've ever read. Tell us about that case really briefly.
Yeah, this is a case out of the Eastern District of New York by the legendary district court judge Jack Weinstein. The essence of the case is that a woman with known mental health problems calls 911 to report child abuse, which is completely fictitious, but of course they don't know that. But in the house where she lives with her sister and brother-in-law, EMTs show up and immediately note that this woman seems to have problems. But they ask to come in so they can have a look at the child, who I think is actually just a couple of weeks old. The husband refuses entry, tells them that he won't let them in. They come back with police officers who demand to come in with the EMTs, and he again refuses, and he says, come back with a warrant, whereupon they push their way into the apartment, beat him up, and examine the child. And I believe the child is brought to the hospital, where it's determined that the child has diaper rash. And so the husband ends up suing the police, arguing that they violated his Fourth Amendment right to be free from unreasonable search and seizure because they barged into his house and beat him up without a warrant. The police argue that they had exigent circumstances because there was a report of a child being abused inside the house, and it gets and of course they assert qualified immunity, which is, you know, essentially the public officials get out of liability free card. And Judge Weinstein does an extraordinarily thoughtful, careful analysis and of the qualified immunity claim and rejects it out of hand, not lightly, but makes clear not only that it has no application in this case, but also points to the recent scholarship, including by IJ friend Professor Will Bode, that suggests that in all likelihood, qualified immunity has no legitimacy whatsoever because it was, like prosecutorial immunity, invented out of whole cloth by the Supreme Court and has absolutely no basis in the text of Section 1983 or any other federal law.
It seems like we're at a really fascinating moment when it comes to qualified immunity jurisprudence, because you have folks out there like Professor Bode who are making these arguments, and they seem to be gaining traction not just among like libertarian Federalist Society types, but, you know, judges like Jack Weinstein, who are as far from a libertarian or conservative Federalist Society type as you can imagine.
Well, absolutely. And it's not just conservative judges. So some conservative judges and even justices, Justice Kennedy and Scalia and Thomas, have all expressed concerns about the sort of originalist legitimacy of qualified immunity. And properly so, because it has none. But just recently, there was a dissent from a denial of I'm sorry, it was actually a dissent from Supreme Court case reversing a Ninth Circuit case that denied qualified immunity to a police officer who shot a woman several times through a fence simply because she was holding a kitchen knife while talking to a neighbor. And in dissenting from that decision, Justices Sotomayor and Ginsburg pointed out the fundamental unfairness of the doctrine and how it essentially gives a judicial imprimatur to extraordinarily problematic and in this case, very close to fatal misconduct on the part of police officers. And I think that's, if you had to pick one thing that's the worst thing about qualified immunity, which is no easy task, I think it's the fact that what it amounts to is a series of judicial green lights to police officers who have engaged in really terrible misconduct, the judges certainly don't mean to be sending that signal, but they absolutely are, because what happens in these cases is somebody says, you violated my rights, and there's a statute that says that I get to sue you and have damages if you violated my rights, and the courts step in, dismiss the lawsuit, and I think police can't help but sort of interpret that as saying, well, I must not have done anything wrong. It's not what the courts mean when they apply qualified immunity, but it is absolutely the signal that they're sending, and police have been responding accordingly. And it's no surprise that people are getting extremely fed up with the amount of force and sometimes lethal force that police are using, oftentimes, you know, without sufficient cause. Because in part, I think what the problem is we don't really have a functioning system for properly determining the amount of force that police can use. Congress created one with Section 1983, and then, of course, the Supreme Court neutered it with qualified immunity. I think it's really one of the worst acts of judicial policymaking that we've ever seen.
Yeah, and one of the most perverse things is the way that when you know, citizens have interactions with the police, citizen behavior has to be perfect. And if they make a mistake, often in extremely stressful, chaotic situations, the police kicking down your door, throwing a flashbang into your house, if you don't behave perfectly, you can be killed with essentially zero accountability. But the police, when they're in similarly chaotic situations, that's basically the get-out-of-jail-free card for them. Like, oh, it was a chaotic situation. It was reasonable for them to behave the way they did.
It's a great point and an absolutely fair description of how the jurisprudence has evolved in this situation. And it's manifest how incredibly unfair that is. I mean, the police have training. They're the ones who initiated the situation. They're the ones who decided what tactics to use and you know, when to execute the raid, for example. And on the other side, you've got a citizen who oftentimes was in a dead sleep in their own home, not expecting anything to happen. And here come a bunch of people barging into their house with shouting, with guns, sometimes with flashbang grenades. And you're exactly right. The judiciary's position on this is, as a citizen, you better do everything perfectly. You better not make any furtive gestures. You better immediately obey every command or they can shoot you. The flip side is, if you're a police officer, they give you so much leeway. Well, you know, it was a chaotic situation and lots of things could happen and your life was in danger. And so, you know, maybe I wouldn't have pulled the trigger, but I'm not here to second guess you. And that is exactly the way that the case law has evolved. And it is unseemly and unjust. And the driver of that incredibly sort of, I think, irrational place that the case law has gotten, where the driver has been qualified immunity, and we can't get rid of it too quickly.
Okay. Well, with that, let's move on to the 11th Circuit and LabMD v. FTC. Clark.
LabMD is an absolutely fascinating case. It's not just one case, as we'll get into in a moment. It's spawned a tremendous amount of litigation. But the essence of the case is this. There was an Atlanta-based medical diagnostic company that had a very particular way of testing for prostate cancer, and they could return test results faster than any other company, which is a really big deal if you're waiting for those results. What happened was that they were approached back in, I think, 2007 by a company called Tyversa that said, you know, we've discovered that you've got a hole in your information security system. We were actually able to obtain one of your patient files, and so you've got this leak, and it's really problematic. The good news is we actually do data security remediation, so we can fix that hole for you. And, you know, if you don't hire us to do that at a rather exorbitant rate, we're going to have to report your data security leak to the Federal Trade Commission, which under a provision of its sort of actuating statute, Section 5 of the FTC Act, gives the FTC power to essentially regulate companies so that they don't treat consumers unfairly. And the FTC has interpreted part of that jurisdiction to include data security practices, which is what was at issue in the LabMD case. Long story short, what happens, the LabMD tells Tyversa essentially, go jump in the lake. This is a shakedown operation. It's clear what you're doing. The Tyversa follows through on its threat, reports the fact that they were able to pull a patient file from LabMD. And the reason it happened, by the way, was that one of the billing managers at LabMD had installed a program on her particular workstation called LimeWire, which was a music sharing program from way back when. But it's a peer-to-peer file sharing program, and so that was what created the hole in the system. And so the question is, what does FTC do with this information that Tyversa hands it about a possible breach of data security at LabMD?
So what do they do?
Well, they open an investigation, and ultimately they go after LabMD with the proverbial meat axe.
Paul?
And the funny thing to me is that if you described these facts to someone and ask who broke the law, you'd think it was Tyversa who's going around and just indiscriminately trying to break into healthcare providers' data.
Yeah, I mean, you'd have to know more about the case, but trust me, every time you peel back a layer of the Tyversa onion, it's worse. The next layer down is worse and worse and worse, to the point where their offices were raided by the FBI several years ago. And the status of that investigation is unknown, because usually the FBI doesn't comment on the status of ongoing investigations. The problem for LabMD was they were never able to get anybody interested or even concerned about the conduct of Tyversa, not the FTC itself, which was frankly in cahoots with Tyversa, and not most of the courts that they appeared in front of, until oral argument in the 11th Circuit in June of 2017, and finally they got the judges interested.
Counsel, let me put it this way. What the aroma that comes out of the investigation in this case is the Tyversa was shaking down private industry with the help of the FTC, will go to the, with the threat of going to the FTC. If you don't cooperate, we will go to the FTC. It may well be how they got some of their clients. But that's an aroma that, and with falsifications to the commission. The administrative law judge just shredded Traverse's presentation, just totally annihilated it.
I'm sorry. I mean,
So
what's the question?
Just an observation.
Yeah. So I mean, my observation is that Traversa's conduct is not really what's at issue here. I mean, there's no question there's no question that Traversa engaged in serious misconduct in connection with
got the commission involved in their shakedowns.
I don't agree with
that. Oh, counsel, come on.
Clark, why don't you tell us who is speaking in that clip and then tell us what the judge means by falsification and the ALJ shredding Traversa's evidence?
Well, I'm not positive who the judges were. One of them was almost certainly Joe Flatt, and I'm not sure of the remaining two judges which the other one was. But that was an exchange between two of the judges on the 11th Circuit panel and the lawyer representing the FTC. And I think to put it in the best light for the FTC, their assertion is, look, it doesn't really matter. The fact that Traversa may be a sleazy kind of data pirate, and the fact that we may have engaged in some unseemly behavior in working with Traversa doesn't change the fact that there was, in fact, a patient file that was accessed through this, you know, hole in LabMD's security. And they're not wrong about that. Factually, that did happen. But actually, I think it is relevant in a way that goes directly to the essence of the 11th Circuit's holding and, frankly, to the essence of the case, and it's this. The FTC's position is that companies have to take reasonable measures to protect the data security of customer, or in this case, patient information. But what constitutes a reasonable measure, of course, is a very difficult question, and one that it's important to remember is not to be answered ex post, after you know what was the nature of the data breach that happened. That's not how policymaking is done. It's not how regulatory guidance is supposed to be provided, because especially with an area like cybersecurity that's changing so rapidly, of course it's easy once, you know, someone's broken into your house in some exotic new way, you know, they came in through your chimney or something, and now you realize, wow, I should have had better security around my chimney. That's essentially what's happening here. The FTC is saying, well, you know, this data pirate broke into your company in this very particular way, and you should have had better security to prevent that. And I want to emphasize that for a moment, because what constitutes reasonable security does in significant part depend on your assessment of the environment that you're operating on. And there's no reason to believe that LabMD's, the patient data in LabMD's possession was unreasonably vulnerable to sort of the ordinary kind of thing that happens when you have that data on a computer. I have personal data scattered all over the country, as do probably virtually everybody listening to this podcast. I just signed up for a dog walking service, and they've got my credit card information and information about my email and my wife's contact information. I mean, are they supposed to hire, you know, a multi-$100,000 data security firm to figure out how to make sure that if a company like Traversa came along and tried to every nook and cranny, every way to crack into that security, that they'd be unsuccessful? I'm telling you right now, I would not be able to afford those dog walking services if that's the standard. And that's the problem with the FTC's approach, is that is exactly their standard.
I'm having visions of Tom Cruise from the first Mission Impossible movie, like dropping down from the ceiling in your dog walker's house to access his computer.
Yeah, and that, I mean, you know, look, should companies incur the kind of expense and resource allocation that would be required to resist the endlessly creative efforts of data pirates like Traversa to crack into their system? I think the answer is clearly no. Why? Because companies could devote all of the resources they have to spend their money on nothing but data security, and somebody would still figure out how to get around it. That's just not a sensible way to regulate companies that provide services to customers, which is what the FTC's charter ultimately is. And so that's a problem. And I want to pick up on one other thing that's very notable in this case. It's notable that the FTC has not done rulemaking for data security. In other words, there's two different ways that regulatory agencies can make policy. They can do rulemaking, which is where you announce an intention to regulate in a particular area. We're going to have a rule on data security. Then you invite people to comment on. Sometimes you issue a proposed rule where I think it's going to look something like this. You invite people to comment on it. You consider those comments and you try to hammer out a good rule. That's the way, I would say that's the default. That's the way it's supposed to be done. But another way, and it turns out the FTC's preferred way to come up with to do rulemaking, it's not rulemaking, but to issue guidance, is they can also do it through what's called litigation or adjudication. They can bring enforcement actions against companies, and then the outcome of that enforcement action essentially becomes the new guidance. Now, here's the problem. The FTC, apparently, this was reported in one of the opinions we're going to talk about, has brought more than 60 data security cases, and in every single one of them, except for the LabMD case, the company entered into a consent decree with the FTC. This is extraordinarily suspicious. When you have a 100% win rate, or in this, and which they had up until the FTC case, it tends to suggest that there's not a level playing field and that there are problems. So every single one of these companies, in effect, knuckled under and said, "Oh, you know, we'll do whatever you say." The FTC's position is that whatever was required in these consent decrees, along with various other, you know, apparently even blog posts that the FTC has done, take all of that together, distill it down to its essence, and that's your guidance about how you should handle cybersecurity. I don't find that credible, and as it turns out, neither did the 11th Circuit.
Yeah, I mean, just imagine the position that puts you in if you're in the regulated community, or if you're a lawyer advising the regulated community, because you can't just turn to the regulations or the statutes. You have to be intimately familiar with every single adjudication that the agency has ever done, because if you miss one of those elements, your client is going to be on the hook.
And even if you're able to do all that, you still won't know exactly what the data security, setup needs to look like in order to pass FTC muster. Why? Because they are constantly deciding after the fact, after there's been a breach, after there's been a problem, they look backwards and say, well, you should have done this. Well, as we talked about earlier, of course, it's easy to say what you should have done after the problem has manifested itself. And that's why they lost in the 11th Circuit. To distill the 11th Circuit's opinion down to its essence, the 11th Circuit acknowledges or emphasizes that these consent decrees, the kind of order that the FTC was trying to impose on LabMD in this case, and that it did impose on other companies, is in the nature of an injunction. And if the FTC believes that you have violated whatever it is that they've ordered you to do by way of having better security, they can actually haul you into court and get a contempt order. And as we know, there's black letter case law that says that orders of that kind, court orders for which the penalty can be a contempt finding, have to be clear and specific. You have to know exactly what it was that was required of you so that if you fail to do it, it's clear that you failed and you don't have to guess at what it is that you were supposed to do. And when you look at the proposed order in this case, or the guidance that the FTC says that it has come up with, it's ephemeral. It's incredibly nonspecific. It has all kinds of value-laden words like reasonable. And looking at that, how could anyone look at that and translate that into concrete, executable instructions to a data security department? The answer is you can't do it. And that's why the 11th Circuit said the FTC's enforcement action in this case had to be dismissed, because what they're essentially ordering this company to do is so open-ended, so vague, so standardless that you would never know. You would never be able to show that that LabMD had failed to comply with any sort of clear and specific guidance. Why? Because there wasn't any.
It's a nice win for a private company. And, you know, another double standard that exists in the legal system that we encounter a fair amount here at IJ is that it can be very difficult to get injunctions against the government, because what courts will say is, well, once we've decided what the government can or can't do, we just presume that they're going to behave and we don't have to have an injunction against them, for which contempt would be a remedy. But if you're a private company, typically, except in this case, you don't have that kind of luck.
Right.
So LabMD is no longer a functioning outfit, Clark. They've laid off all their employees, they've ceased operations, and yet this lawsuit continues. And it doesn't apply to only LabMD. Talk about what LabMD is doing these days.
Yeah, I mean, it is a sad story. The FTC investigation bled LabMD dry, which the proprietor, the company's president, Mike Doherty, believes. I know him, and he believes that was the whole point of the FTC investigation. In fact, I think he might go so far as to say that is exactly the point of all FTC investigations, is to raise the very real specter that they will bleed your company dry if you don't enter into a consent order. And the fact that everybody up until him, every company up until his company did lend some support for that. But so the company is defunct because it ran out of money fighting for its principles against the FTC investigation. But it still maintains all of this patient data, which reside on hard drives that remain in the possession of the company in, I believe, in Mike Doherty's garage somewhere. And the FTC was trying to impose an ongoing future-looking order on LabMD. So the court in a footnote acknowledges that, you know, while the company is not actually a going concern anymore, there's still a live controversy because this data is being preserved and there are obligations to hold it confidential. But this is not the only litigation that's going on involving LabMD, not by a long stretch.
Which brings us to the D.C. Circuit.
Yeah, so there's the case in the D.C. Circuit, an opinion just came down a couple weeks ago, where this lawsuit involves, this is a Bivens action where Mike Doherty and LabMD have sued a number of the attorneys for the Federal Trade Commission who initiated and continued the enforcement action. They initiated an investigation. It turned into an enforcement action, and they were the attorneys that drove that train. The essence of LabMD's position in that case is that that either the enforcement action was initiated or quote unquote ramped up, not for legitimate investigative or enforcement purposes, but essentially out of animus, an attempt to retaliate against LabMD and in particular Mike Doherty, the president of LabMD, for publicizing and criticizing the FTC's conduct and ultimately for writing a book, which he has done. It's a great book called The Devil Inside the Beltway, which is an absolutely fascinating read about the whole history of this case. And in the complaint, for example, they allege things like a paralegal accessed the website that was created by Mike Doherty to promote the book within days before some new uptick in the intensity of the investigation happened. And they put together a lot of circumstantial evidence like that. But ultimately, the D.C. Circuit holds that there is no clearly established right. So, you know, qualified immunity has made its appearance. There is no clearly established right to be free from an enforcement action that is informed in part by vindictive or retaliatory motives, unless you clearly allege that that was the but-for cause of the government's actions.
Yeah, and so this raises really, really difficult issues if you are trying to allege First Amendment retaliation, because, you know, we were talking about overcriminalization. There's so much overcriminalization that the government essentially always has enforcement discretion when it goes after people. It can't go after everybody who has committed whatever offense it is. And so they get to pick and choose. And in that situation, you're almost never going to be able to show that the fact that they targeted you for your speech was the but-for cause, because, of course, they think that you actually broke the law.
Right. And there's a case pending in the Supreme Court this term on that precise issue, Lozman versus City of Riviera Beach, where the issue in the case is that a citizen of Riviera Beach has an issue. He's been in conflict with the city council a number of times before, including a case that went up to the Supreme Court a couple of years before involving a boat that he kept in the marina. And at a city council meeting, Lozman goes up to the podium, has some uncharitable things to say about the city council, but he's speaking in very measured tones. He's not in any way disrupting the meeting. He's just saying some things they don't want to hear. And then within 15 seconds, the presiding city council member has not only ordered him to stop speaking, but has in fact directed a police officer to put him under arrest and to remove him from the room.
Yeah, so the legal issue that the Supreme Court is considering in that case, and that it will actually decide within probably the next week or so, is, does the mere fact that there is probable cause to arrest someone defeat a claim for First Amendment retaliation? And the argument seems to have gone well for Fain Lozman. The court seems to be very concerned with what happened to him, and with good reason, because, again, the police can always stop you and arrest you for something. If a city council member doesn't like you, they can tell the police, follow this guy in his car until he changes lanes without signaling, or until he goes 1 mile an hour over the speed limit, and then arrest him and make his life difficult. And there are some circuits that say that's perfectly fine. That doesn't raise a First Amendment problem. And there are others that say that's an obvious First Amendment problem. So hopefully the Supreme Court will agree that that raises serious First Amendment issues.
Yeah, and the problem here and in the D.C. Circuit LabMD case is the same, and that is that just like other human beings, government officials sometimes act in ways that are petty and vindictive. And the question is, in what cases should the judiciary care about that? In what cases should someone who believes they've been a victim of that kind of petty and vindictive behavior, and not just behavior, but exercise of official power? We're talking here about allegations that public officials have used their government-conferred authority in a way that is petty and vindictive to deprive you of various rights, the right of free expression or just the right to be free from retaliatory arrest. And I think one thing that's very interesting is that mixed motive issues come up all the time. One area where they come up all the time is employment law. And because the courts care about providing justice for people who claim to have been victims of unlawful employment actions, they've constructed these very elaborate burden-shifting doctrines and ways to drill down into alleged cases of mixed motives and determine, you know, kind of what actually happened and whether there should be legal liability. And I think it's very interesting and telling that when it's the government that is alleged to have engaged in some kind of mixed motive, retaliation, which is the allegation in the LabMD case and also the Lozman case, the judiciary's attitude seems to be much different. The attitude seems to be, well, we could never really figure this out, which is false, because we know that, again, they have these elaborate mechanisms for getting to the bottom of it in other settings. And what they really mean is, I think, that A, it's just not worth it, and B, imagine what a hassle it would be for these government officials to be hauled into court by mere citizens and have their motives subjected to judicial examination to determine whether their motives were primarily pure or primarily vindictive. What a hassle that would be. As I'm sure you can tell from my tone of voice, I do think that this is a double standard, and I think it's a largely indefensible double standard. If it is objectionable for a Walmart or a McDonald's to engage in employment practices that are illegal, even if they're a result of a mixed motive, your manager really didn't think you were a very good performer, but he also had a racial animus towards you. Well, guess what? The judiciary makes a really, really stringent effort to get to the bottom of that case and figure out what really happened. I don't really understand why, if the judiciary is prepared to make that kind of an effort in a case involving a private employer, they shouldn't also be willing to make that effort in a case involving a possible abuse of government power. In fact, that might be the even more important setting in which to be committed to getting to the bottom of what really happened.
Yeah, and if this double standard sounds familiar to listeners, it's because it's the exact same double standard that exists in the Supreme Court's rational basis case law, where there's all sorts of situations where the court will try to figure out what was going on in a private citizen's mind. But you can see a clearly protectionist piece of legislation. It's clearly a giveaway to special interests. Everyone knows that's what it is. And the court will say, well, how could we possibly know what was going on in the legislature's mind? Sure, the legislation was written by the protected interest group, and sure, there's no discernible public benefit. But who are we to say?
Right. And change one thing, right? Instead of having it be a restriction on who can practice a given occupation, have it be a restriction on who can advertise the same service. And suddenly the courts, will completely change their mindset and say, oh my goodness, hold the phone. This is an advertising restriction. You're actually interfering with somebody's speech. Oh, we can get to the bottom of that. And we will get to the bottom of that. So it's just a pure act of judicial will. It's not the case that they can't get to the bottom of mixed motives when it's a big employer or a city council or the Federal Trade Commission. It's that they choose not to for policy reasons.
Okay, let's move on to the final case now, which comes out of the Ninth Circuit, and it involves a lawyer with quite a bit of racial animus.
Well, this is a horrible case. Any way you chop it, it involves a homicide back in 1989. The defendant was prosecuted for that homicide. Ultimately, he was convicted. He had a court-appointed lawyer that it turns out later was a notorious racist. It's unclear from the opinion how well known this was at the time that he was appointed to represent the defendant, but it became very clear within years after that that he was not a garden variety kind of racist. I mean, a really just virulent racist who there's evidence in the record that was gathered by attorneys in different cases in which this lawyer participated that he not only expressed racial animus, but specifically said about his own clients who were black, that, you know, he hoped they got what was coming to them, or that they're too stupid to be, you know, outside of prison or whatever it might be. And the question in this case is whether, and so the defendant in this case pursues the Sixth Amendment ineffective assistance of counsel claim long after he's been convicted. And his argument, in essence, is, look, it is impossible to be properly represented by a lawyer that holds such a deep, abiding, and virulent animus against me because of my race. That's the essence of his claim, and the Ninth Circuit very reluctantly rejects it.
And they do so because they feel that they're bound by earlier Ninth Circuit precedent.
That's exactly right. All three judges on the panel, in a short opinion, say we are bound by existing circuit precedent to apply a standard in which we are not allowed to presume that you were prejudiced by your lawyer's racial animus. Instead, under existing precedent, you have to show that there was some particular thing that he did during the representation that prejudiced you. And because you haven't alleged that and you haven't been able to show it, then all we've got is a presumption that you must have been harmed by this animus. Incredibly, the circuit precedent that they're referring to was a case involving the same lawyer. And so you get this extremely unsatisfying outcome, which is that this individual who had apparently coined it, the opinion says that the lawyer was appointed, so presumably it was a court-appointed lawyer, who in retrospect turns out to be a terrible person and certainly a terrible lawyer who actually has hatred for his own clients because of their race. You're looking back, you're saying, look, I didn't know it at the time, but it's clear now that this person was a racist and had no business representing me. The judges on this panel are so unsettled by the result that all three of them join a short concurring opinion in which they say that if they were not bound by circuit precedent, they would have reached a different result in which they would have said, when the racism is this virulent, we should presume that that the assistance of counsel was by definition ineffective. But again, they feel bound to apply existing circuit precedent, which requires a showing of some specific prejudice that occurred. That's not in the record, so he loses.
Yeah, and for listeners who, you know, maybe don't read appellate opinions on a daily basis, this is a really extraordinary signal from the court. It's not that unusual to see a single judge on a three-judge panel say, oh, I feel bound by this precedent, but I think the precedent is wrong. But to see all three judges on a panel say that is really pretty remarkable. I've only seen it, I think, a handful of times.
And interestingly, as with the previous discussion we had about retaliatory actions on the part of the government, there was a Supreme Court case this term that was somewhat similar to this, insofar as it relates to the relationship between a defendant and his or her counsel and the importance of that relationship and the importance of the ability of a client to fully trust in his or her counsel. It was a case called McCoy versus the state of Louisiana, another homicide case. And what happened in that case is that the lawyer and the client, the defendant McCoy, had a disagreement about strategy. McCoy wanted to offer an alibi defense and argue that the homicide that he'd been accused of was most likely committed by some rogue police officers, and the victims were wrapped up in some kind of a drug conspiracy with those police officers. The defense counsel felt that there was insufficient evidence to support those arguments or that theory of the case, and instead decided that the better strategy would be to admit guilt, admit that the defendant had killed the people, and hope for leniency and be spared the death penalty.
How'd that work out for him?
Did not work out. The jury came back with the death penalty. They convicted and sentenced him to death. And the case went up to the Supreme Court because the argument was, look, as a defendant, as the person who is accused of this crime, the ultimate decision about what strategy to adopt and specifically about whether to admit guilt or to offer a defense is up to me, not my counsel. And the Supreme Court agreed with that. And an opinion that picks up on a wonderful amicus brief that was written by my colleague and former IJ law clerk Jay Schweikert, Justice Ginsburg really picks up very much on the theme of the Cato amicus brief that Jay wrote, which argues that the essence of this case is client autonomy and the ability of the client to decide, even at the risk of being put to death, whether they are going to defend themselves, to admit guilt, or to adopt some other trial strategy, even if it's one that their attorney does not think is a good idea, they still get to make that choice. Why? Because of autonomy.
Well, hopefully, given kind of that concern by the Supreme Court and the signal sent by these three judges on the Ninth Circuit, you know, it seems like there might be a decent chance of the en banc Ninth Circuit revisiting some of that precedent.
Okay, that concludes the show. Thanks for listening. We appreciate you. Until next time, this is John Ross from the Institute for Justice, qualifying you to get engaged.